You're listening to the Doheny Podcast Network. The Doheny Eye Institute, working for all to see. Your host is Jody Becker.
You're listening to the best of the Doheny Podcast Network. In this special edition, we'll hear first from Doheny doctors Olivia Lee and Laura Vickers with their in-depth observations about their mission to Mongolia last spring. They trained colleagues as they performed corneal transplants there. Later in the show, a conversation with Dr. Alfredo Sadoun about his ongoing research in gene therapy and Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. First, mission to Mongolia. This is our first international episode, and it's inspired by your recent trip to Mongolia, where you traveled together to perform corneal transplant surgeries for several patients and train Mongolian colleagues in surgical procedures and aftercare protocols. Our listeners should know that they can read and look at amazing pictures about this trip at doheny.org. I don't know how you had time to blog about it, but the blog is absolutely beautiful, and I thought that our listeners might want to know even more. So I wanted to just start with background. First, if you could explain how this particular trip came together, and then function of the cornea. Dr. Vickers, can you talk a little bit about how you got to Mongolia and how the whole trip came together?
Sure. So Mongolia is a country that some people may have never considered visiting before or may not know very much about, especially if you're living in the United States. But it's a relatively large country, which is very, very sparsely populated. So it's actually one of the most sparsely populated countries in the world. It's situated just between Russia and China. The culture is somewhat of a mix between Russia, China, and a smattering of European cultures as well. It's a very interesting place, and the native language is Mongolian, which is notoriously one of the most difficult languages to learn around the world. So we actually ended up going to Mongolia specifically on this mission because I had been there in the past as a medical student. I had had the opportunity and the privilege to start a small eye care mission there that then got continued by doctors throughout the years. And so it was one of my kind of dedications to myself after my medical training that I would do a cornea transplant fellowship because I knew that people around the world and specifically in Mongolia didn't have access to cornea transplants. And I wanted to go back and to share that knowledge and to help them establish an eye bank. So Dr. Lee also got really excited about this idea. And so together we decided to go back to Mongolia this year and to start this cornea transplant program.
Dr. Lee, how does the cornea work?
So the cornea is the clear covering in front of the eye. It is normally transparent in a healthy patient. So when you look at yourself in the mirror and you see the colored part of the eye, actually you're looking through the cornea. So if you are a contact lens wearer, every day you put your contact lens on top of the cornea. When the cornea is not clear, then this can cause decreased vision. And the cornea can become cloudy for a variety of reasons, either infection, inflammation, trauma, scarring, etc. So we are corneal transplant surgeons, and what we do is we take a cornea from a cadaver, a person who has generously donated their cornea to another person, and we transplant that onto the patient to restore their vision.
If people take a look on the blog, there are photographs of the equipment. And also, of course, you traveled with some donated corneas. Can you talk about how you got all of this together and the logistics of making this mission possible?
Logistics, yes. As you say, it sounds much easier than it actually was. It was about 6 months of hard work on both of our parts. We had to get donations from many different eye care companies that provide all of the materials and instruments that are needed for cornea transplant surgery. Luckily, there are also several nonprofits such as See International, which were willing to partner with us and to loan or donate equipment and instruments that we needed. Luckily, cornea transplant surgery on the scale of surgeries is actually one of the lower tech surgeries in terms of we don't actually need any big machines with fancy screens or computers in order to do the surgery itself. So that is actually an advantage of the surgery being a little bit more portable than, for example, some kinds of retina surgery, et cetera. But one of the biggest expenses and one of the biggest barriers in general to doing cornea transplant surgery in any place that doesn't do it now is getting the corneas.
Dr. Lee?
I have a very good relationship with SightLife Eye Bank in Seattle. It is one of the largest eye banks in the United States, and they process a lot of corneal tissue for United States surgeons as well as international surgeons. This is a nonprofit organization, and their mission is to eliminate corneal blindness, not just in the United States, but worldwide. We're doing a great job in the U.S. There really is no patient in the United States who is waiting for a corneal transplant. Unlike a person who is waiting for a liver or a kidney or a heart transplant, you could literally walk into a corneal transplant surgeon's office, schedule a surgery on whatever day you want, and have the reassurance that a cornea will be available on the day of surgery. That is not the case in most countries. So, for example, in Mongolia, even though there are these two cornea-trained surgeons, they really have no ability to do the surgery that they're trained to do because of lack of corneas. So our mission and SightLife's mission to eliminate this problem are really in line here. So they're very motivated to help us in this regard. They're very generous to donate to us six corneas for transplantation, and we use that to regain sight in six patients. There were 10 non-transplant grade corneas that were donated, and we use these in the laboratory to have the physicians and the residents who came, there were about 16 of them, and we use that in conjunction with pig eyes to simulate corneal transplantation in the laboratory. So even the surgeons who were not able to actually participate in the surgeries of the six patients were able to practice corneal transplantation.
And you traveled with those in a special freezer, is that right?
Actually, they can just be stored with regular ice. So they're packaged in a culture media called Optisol. And in that solution, they can stay for 7 days and simply in a styrofoam box with normal ice.
Can you talk a little bit? You said you had been to Mongolia in the past. Did you have a connection with this specific hospital or colleagues there?
I did. So this was actually the hospital that we had found through an international network of eye surgeons back when I was a medical student. And so this network, again, called See International, they both are a nonprofit that's based in Santa Monica here in California. And they actually both provide donated instruments and loaned equipment for eye surgeons from the United States who want to travel abroad and do surgical skills transfer. And they also have formed this amazing international network of eye surgeons abroad who want to host United States trained ophthalmic surgeons. And they have special requests about which kinds of surgery they really need in their country. And so this was how many years ago, back in 2008, I got in touch with Dr. Mugi, who is a cornea-trained specialist who had gone to India and then went back to her hometown of Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, in order to be a cornea doctor. Of course, she wanted additional training and training for more doctors in Mongolia for cornea transplant technique, and also the help in the starting an eye bank. And so this was one of the initial goals back in 2008 and finally came to fruition when we went back this year.
And something that you've mentioned already is that the language is a very tricky and obscure language that not very many people know. So I'm wondering how you communicated, and especially in terms of things that are very technical, like performing surgeries and aftercare protocols and very specific medical terminology.
The medical doctors all speak English. They're very familiar with the eye terminology. At least most of them are. I think they could understand me. I'm not sure if the nurses or the patients could understand, but they did serve as our translator. When we did give our lectures, just to make sure that there was no misunderstanding and everyone understood to the detail that we wanted to teach, we did have a translator during the lectures.
And I want to just wrap up. I know that you're off to do a surgery this morning and we don't have much more of your time, but I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the patients, the six transplantations that you actually did in patients there.
Sure. So this we had only six corneas. We wish we had the opportunity to do more because there were probably 50-some patients that came from all across Mongolia to see us and be evaluated for potentially having corneal transplant surgery. Of these, we selected six good candidates for what we call penetrating keratoplasty or a full-thickness corneal transplantation. One of these, you'll see on the blog that is mentioned, is a 3-month-old baby boy who has a congenital disease called sclerocornea. It is a very rare condition, and he has it in both eyes, and so he's been born blind. And without a corneal transplant, he would never have the ability to see. And if this transplantation wasn't done in the first couple of years of life, he would never be able to regain his sight, even if he had the transplant in the future as an adult. A lot of people reading the blog were very touched by the story about the baby. And the baby is going to have the other eye done on June 11th. So we're very appreciative of Sight Life Eye Bank for their generous donation. And of course, we're very grateful for all the corneal donors out there who are generous in giving their eyes to save the sight of another person. The other five patients, one had a condition called keratoconus, which is a bulging forward of the cornea due to lack of mechanical strength in the cornea. There were two patients who suffered traumatic events. One was fixing his car when a tire blew up in his eye. There was also a patient who had a viral infection in the past that left him with scarring. And these are very common things that we see in the United States as well. But the pathology is more advanced over there, meaning any of these patients, if they had been in the United States, would have gotten their corneal transplantation much earlier because of access to care and availability of corneas.
Very inspiring. Thank you so much. And finally, I'm just wondering, are there plans to return?
Yes, definitely. Yes, so we definitely want to. Go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to say that we're planning to return next year, most likely in July. And we would really like to be able to go back in order to teach more advanced cornea transplantation techniques and also to teach glaucoma and expand the subspecialty training that we're doing to a broader scope of diseases as well.
Thank you both so much. Unbelievably interesting information. Pictures and more of your words are at doheny.org. Our guests on the Doheny Podcast Network have been Dr. Olivia Lee and Dr. Laura Vickers talking about their recent trip to Mongolia and the cornea transplants they performed and the corneal transplantation training they did with colleagues in Mongolia. Thank you both so very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
In the second half of this DPN special edition, a conversation with Dr. Alfredo Sidoun about his ongoing research in gene therapy and Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. This conversation we had last spring has been downloaded thousands of times around the world. Thanks for listening to this Encore edition. My guest is Dr. Alfredo Sidoun, a world-renowned specialist in neuro-ophthalmology. Dr. Sidoun's 30 years of experience in the field have earned him an international reputation for research and treatment for diseases of the optic nerve. His work has shaped the prognosis for eye disease patients around the world, and he believes many of the breakthroughs are the result of collaboration, a philosophy we'll talk about in this show. In 2012, Dr. Sidoun was recognized with the highest clinical distinction in neuro-ophthalmology, the Hoyt Award. Dr. Sidoun, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to have this conversation.
So I would love to start with the hottest news, which is the gene therapy treatment now available to some retina disease patients. It's a huge breakthrough, years in the making. I'm wondering if you can trace the trajectory of the research and talk with us a little bit about how it works and why it works.
Well, first of all, I completely share with you a great deal of excitement about this newest and a number of different approaches we've taken to this disease. This particular occasion, we're trying to go for something which was thought to be too challenging technically just a few years ago, which is to get a gene that goes into a virus that would go into the eye that infects the over 1 million cells that are otherwise impaired by this disease and hopefully rescues them. What made it so technically challenging is, like other gene therapy, the mutated gene in the disease is not in the nucleus, not where the other 30 or 35,000 genes are harbored, but rather in this tiny speck in the periphery of the cell of the mitochondria. And that's challenging because you've got to get the gene that the virus carries not to go where the virus wants to put it, which is in the nucleus, but ultimately you want to get the protein that's made by that into the mitochondria. If it works, and I think we might find that out very shortly because of the very dramatic disease we're testing it in, if it works, it would open the door to treating all mitochondrial diseases.
And what does that really mean when you say if it works, it could work in treating all mitochondrial diseases? I mean, it sounds like the implications of that are enormous.
There's a large number of mitochondrial diseases that are genetic. Some very tragic diseases like Lee's disease, where children who are normal at age 2 develop terrible problems by age 3 and die at age 4. Now, these are general diseases of the body. But here we have, in this particular occasion, a system that's very pure and very well worked out, which is a disease called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy that's exclusively to the optic nerve. And when we say the optic nerve, that's the part that connects the eye to the brain. But the front part is a lining of over 1 million cells called retinal ganglion cells. And that's really where the problem exists. And fortunately, that's also where access is great, because an injection in the middle of the eye into the clear gel that fills the eye with the virus will allow contact by that virus to all the cells of interest.
Could you give us a little bit more of a description of your work and sort of how the research has led up to the current breakthrough?
It begins with this disease that actually has been known for a couple hundred years but misunderstood, which is remarkable and mysterious. Typically, it'll be a young man who will suddenly go blind in one eye, maybe around age 18, and a few weeks later, the other. And unfortunately, this is a profound, severe, and irreversible bilateral blindness that seems to mysteriously just come out of nowhere. It's easy to say it's genetic, but then why did he have 18 good years first? And so it's attracted the attention of a number of people like me who are neuro-ophthalmologists, but also a lot of geneticists, because it turned out in 1988 that we figured out it was always due to a mutation in the genes of the mitochondria. And it was about that time that I also developed this great interest in this disease. And maybe the most compelling event that occurred in the year 2000, when I was contacted by this new modality called email by a person in rural Brazil. She was a very smart lady and heard about the email system, used it to contact me after having researched over the internet and concluded herself as being a member of a huge family with this disease. This seemed almost absurd because most ophthalmologists have a hard time diagnosing this very rare disease. But of course, it turned out she was right. And in contacting me, it led to us being able to send her to collaborators at the University of Sao Paulo, which was not a small thing because she was way deep in the rural interior of Brazil, and it took many days of bus rides for her, her newly affected son, and her two older brothers who had gone blind when they were teenagers. And that led to us putting together a team that at its maximum had 45 people. And we've gone back every year to the same rural corner of Brazil to examine the same 300 patients and to see how they progress year after year. And so that is what you began by speaking about, which is this collaborative environment, which has led to some, I think, very major understandings of the disease and new avenues of research.
So you're talking a lot about the significance of the research, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about how significant these breakthroughs will be in treatment.
Well, as an example, the very first treatment that we tried was for a certain chemical that would carry off the extra electron that we calculated was accumulating in the cells. And this first chemical is called idibenone, and it has now become, I hesitate to call it the standard of care because it's not in this country. But it is the standard of care in Europe. In this country, the FDA has not yet approved its use. But even as I'm sort of bragging that our work helped lead to this being used throughout Europe and Canada, it doesn't work very well. But from that, we came to a second chemical, which is a little bit better, something called Epi-743. And from that, I think we moved into now a combination of two chemicals that are going to work particularly well. But at the same time, a group of people in this country and a competing group of people in Paris, France, have been working on this problem of getting the gene to be able to go into these cells and carry the information specifically to the mitochondria.
So gene therapy is here, but still for most people, it sounds very futuristic. Can you demystify it a little bit and talk about sort of the practical nature of the clinical approach?
Well, maybe first some caveats. Gene therapy began about 20 or 25 years ago with tremendous promise. And the thought was that you could go in and fix any genetic defect by having a virus carry the correct gene in. But despite the fact that there was great enthusiasm, there were also problems that maybe had not been fully anticipated. And there were some tragic consequences. One in particular happened in Pennsylvania, where a young man who had an immunodeficiency disease caused by a missing gene developed a viral infection when the virus was given to him that eventually caused his demise. So the U.S. government, quite appropriately, I think, put an enormous number of brakes on gene therapy. So there's been this long period of time where maybe the rest of the world has moved further forward than we have. But the cautious approach has allowed for all sorts of checks, including suicide genes that make sure that the virus that you use cannot replicate, can't travel, can't go elsewhere. So I think now, in a very cautious way, we're seeing this second wave of developments with gene therapy. And even in the eye, it has been put to extremely important use. About 2-3 years ago, it was applied for another type of disease, which is a form of retinitis pigmentosa. The gene did go where it was supposed to, and it did improve the status of those patients. This approach that we're doing is both harder but more promising. Harder because we have to get the gene in the mitochondria, more promising for the same reason. And because we think we can do the injections within a shorter period of time after the loss of vision, I think it's also going to be more dramatic in terms of restoring vision. But you know, we've only injected a couple people, so it's a little early yet to talk about the positive results.
It's exactly what I was hoping you would explain for us. Finally, how accessible will this treatment be for patients?
Well, this particular trial is for 36 patients with Leber's, this very rare disease. We will know probably within 1 year whether it works. But I should mention that it's a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. That's the best level of science, but it means that in each occasion, one eye will be injected with virus and one eye will not. The other eye will be a sham injection. The patient won't know which is which. I won't know which is which. We take advantage here of the fact that UCLA has two eye centers, and so that this research is being done by our group at the Doheny, but the actual injections will be done at the Jules Stein, making it easier to have a firewall of ignorance so we won't know which eye is which. And then we will just let the data speak for itself as the information comes in over the next 12 months. If this all works out, to me, the really exciting thing might happen in about 3 years, when it might be that the proof of principle allows other mitochondrial diseases to be treated the same way.
Can you talk a little bit about your encounters with patients who have realized improved vision through your treatments?
Well, first I should set the context and say that the majority of patients with this disease have their lives devastated. It's really quite the tragedy. I don't think it could be psychologically worse than to have a person who's about to go off to college, if we're talking about U.S. patients, without any idea that they have this time bomb in them. They have plans and girlfriends and all these things, and then suddenly they wake up blind in one eye, and a few weeks later in the other eye, and then are told it's not going to get better. That's the rule, not the exception. However, we've had a few effective treatments, and in the last year, I would say that maybe as high as a third of my patients have responded to such therapy, gotten their vision back, and just as depressed as they might have been initially, they're exhilarated at this second chance at life.
So as you're saying, it's truly life-changing.
Most certainly.
Dr. Sadoun, thank you so much for being with us. It's extraordinary research and now treatment that you are able to offer with your colleagues. I know you also have significant research relating to Alzheimer's and many other interests and areas of expertise, so I hope you will come back again soon. Thank you again.
It would be my great pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the best of the Doheny Podcast Network. Thanks for listening to this Encore edition.
The Doheny Eye Institute, at the forefront in eradicating eye disease for nearly 70 years, is dedicated to providing state-of-the-art clinical services and supporting leading researchers in the quest for treatments that stabilize and improve the precious sense of sight. Doheny is now affiliated with UCLA Stein Eye Institute. For more information about our doctors and their innovative work in the quest for better vision, visit our website, doheny.org.